Hello, I'm Jeff Lester and welcome to Wait, What? Comics podcast for the Savage Critics website. In the second of two installments for episode 10, it's The Lightning Round, as Graham McMillan and I talk about Bakuman by the creators of Death Note, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake by Amy Bender, The Unsinkable Walker Bean by Aaron Reiner, Drinking Into Movies by Julia Wirtz, Black Panther's Jungle Action Marvel Masterworks by Don McGregor, Rich Buckler, Billy Graham, Day Tripper by Gabriel Ba and Fabio Moon, Set to Sea by Dree Wine, and many more. We hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening.
Jeff, comics, go!
That was very well done. That could have been the opening to a Grant Morrison comic. I'm very impressed.
Okay, but now, comics, what have you been reading recently, sir?
Well, okay. One of the things that I read was, I'm not going to remember the name of it. It's the follow-up series. It's the manga, the first volume by the guys who did Death Note. I want to say it's called Bakuman, just because it sounds so much like, stupid idiot. It's a series, weirdly enough, as you would expect the writer and artist who created Death Note to do. It is
called Bakuman, by the way.
Oh, is it? B-A-K-U-M-A-N? Yeah. Oh, thank God. I'm so glad I didn't screw that up. It's a novel about two school youth who vow to become successful manga creators. And it really was just the weirdest damn idea. I didn't know that it was out. Hibbs pointed it my way a week ago, and I just lent it to Lauren Davis because she was also a Death Note fan. And it's amazing how un-Death Notian it is in a lot of ways. I mean, it's, you know, because they're like guys who are, you know, there's no demons. There's a few things that feel a little bit like there might be some heavy-handed. The only supernatural factor so far might be fate. I don't think it's really going to go beyond that, you know, the conception of destiny or something. But it's basically, manga so prides its, you know, is such a strong subgenre of manga, is that idea, the sort of the let's be the best genre, you know, in which some student decides to become the best, you know, tennis player or ping pong player or serial killer or whatever it is. And seeing it done about manga is kind of, it's one of those weird things of like, wow, I didn't think it was going to work, because it seems like kind of a trite idea. But it totally sucked me in. I had a great time reading it. When I got to the end, I was very bummed that I was going to have to wait 3 months until the second volume is due out in November or something god awful like that. I really enjoyed it. It's one of those things that it'd be kind of tough to recommend to people who love Death Note, because it's so far, it's not very much like that. But for people who really kind of like it's almost like a perfect young adult novel so far, in that it has one or two hooks and it just really nails you with kind of the... It never lets you get bored. Just when you think that you figure out where it's going to go, it either throws you a curve ball or it throws in another weird story hook. So I tell you what, let's alternate. That's what I read. I've got a few more up my sleeve. How about you?
Would you like comics or prose?
Ooh.
The reason I say that is because you mentioned young adult. I just finished the new Amy Bender novel, mm-hmm. The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Have you ever read Amy Bender?
I have not.
Amy Bender is... I'm going to call her a magical realist. She is a Los Angeles-based writer who is one of these writers that every time someone is like, they should bring such and such a writer into comics, Amy Bender is such a natural for comics and is a massive comics fan that I can't believe no one's brought her into comics. It's insane. The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake is about a girl who, when she is 9 years old, realizes that when she eats food, she can taste the emotions of the people who made it.
Ah, right.
Much like Chew, the John Layman series. But really, it's about her adolescence and the fact that her brother has an equally strange gift, but a very different gift that comes out very slowly throughout the course of the novel. It's very much about alienation and it's really good, but it's also incredibly depressing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't actually realize how depressing it was until I finished the book. And I read it in the space of about 2 days. I love Amy Bender. Amy Bender's one of these writers for me who I will drop everything to read an Amy Bender. But it's really, really heavy stuff. And it when you're reading, you don't really realize, because it's very much written in the tone of voice of a girl going from 9 to 17.
Right.
But it doesn't really spoil anything. But by the end of the book, she has become so withdrawn from everyone because she cannot eat with people.
Wow.
That it's really, I mean, it's incredibly dark. It's a beautiful book. It's heartbreaking. But yeah, just when you said young adult, you reminded me that I had read that. In the more light comic field, I read The Unsinkable Walker Bean, which is the new Aaron Reiner book, the guy who did Spiralbound. And it's pretty much exactly what you'd want if someone said Harry Potter with pirates, if that makes sense. It's wonderfully done. It's very much of the, you know, I don't want to say boys on adventure, but kind of that genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, adventure in the high seas. It's really great, though. It's really good.
Huh. That sounds fantastic. What's it called again?
It's called The Unsinkable Walker Bean.
Walker Bean. And it's a graphic novel?
It is a graphic novel from First Second.
From First Second. Wow. That sounds fantastic.
And I believe it's coming out next month. I might have the release date wrong.
Okay. I will return your volley and say that I've been reading, thanks to the wonderful Lauren Davis, an advanced galley of Drinking at the Movies by Julia Wirtz, also a.k.a. Fart Party Julia Wirtz.
And,
it's a really interesting read for me, because they sort of pitch it on the back like it's her first full-length graphic novel. And it's really not. Like, it really weaves in and out of, I think it might be kind of interesting to see if it's going to backfire on them marketing it that way, because it's very much like Fart Party 3, just with longer stories interspersed between the individual single-page cartoons, or the single-page strips are sort of chronologically laid out. So there is a sense of getting, you know, a year in her life, although I'd have to look and make sure, it might be more than a year. But basically, it covers the ground from when she moves from San Francisco to New York. It pretty much starts off with her New York arrival. And I'm not quite finished with it, but I love her stuff. I actually was really shocked that people were doing a Kickstarter project to get Fart Party Volume 1 back in print, because I love that book, and it was like a huge, you know, because she lived in San Francisco, she sold the zines directly to Comics Experience, and I loved them. So it's really interesting seeing this cartoonist who, her cartooning is like, it's very minimal. It works. Her pacing really works. But, like, for people who complain about Dilbert, for example, I'm always surprised that they don't start taking a you know, pinata bat to Wirtz's work, because her actual range of what she can draw, or the style in which she draws, is pretty minimal and not particularly adept per se. But mm-hmm. Her sense of humor is great. Her ability to tell a story is great. Her worldview is really unique, and it's, you know, it's a really, in that sense, it's a very infectious read. I've really been enjoying the hell out of it, and I'll be really curious to see what the reception's like when it comes out, because she's really an impressively significant talent, but in one of those weird, like, you know, ways that people can identify with her, but she's also, but you know, but she makes Kathy Goosewaite look like an incredibly talented artist. You know,
but that makes me think of, and I can never remember the guy's last name, the guy just King Cat Comics,
oh,
who
yeah.
again, as an artist, is, mm-hmm. let's be polite, limited.
Yeah.
But makes it work.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's actually
a
great comparison.
As a benefit. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. He has a blurb on the back of Drinking at the Movies, in fact. So good call there.
Thanks. To return your volley, sir, I read a galley of, what is it called? It's called How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less, which is Sarah Glidden. It's a Vertigo book, and Vertigo are calling it her debut graphic novel. It's actually a collection and expansion of her own mini comics.
Oh, interesting.
It's really good. It's something that actually took me a really long time to get into. Mm-hmm. It's a very quiet book, for want of a better way of putting it, and it's something that I think deserves to be read all in one, as opposed to piecemeal, which mm-hmm. makes me really interested to read it in mini comics, because I don't think it had the same impact at all. Again, it's not true. I was going to say she's one of these artists who may not be, her visual style may not really gain a lot of fans, but I think that's unfair. I think the way she paints in the book is her style, because there are parts where she breaks that style to do something more realistic, and it's wonderful. It's a really, really, really interesting book. It's a memoir of her taking a Birthright Israel tour. Mm-hmm. And she goes with the point of view that Israel is going to try and brainwash her in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Wow.
And is very upfront about that, both mm-hmm. in the narration and as the character. Mm-hmm. And by the time she leaves, essentially has realized that it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. And it's a book, as much as anything, about... the complications of war and the disillusionment of having such strongly held ideals. Hmm. It's really good.
That sounds great.
It's coming out in November, I think.
November from Vertigo, huh?
Yes. And the galley I had was not a complete version. It is missing. There are apparently end notes that she's going to add to explain a lot of the things that happened.
Hmm.
And also, I got a black and white galley in the final book will be in color. If you go to her website, which I've just looked up because I'm being professional, it's smallnoises.com, all one word, small noises. Uh-huh. There's a preview of it up there.
Fantastic.
It's a really, really interesting book. It's really worth reading.
Great.
And now you.
Ah, well, this may be my closing volley or not, depending on if we're sticking to the graphic novel reading.
I've already broken out of that by talking about Amy Bender, so...
Yeah, that is true. Right, well then we'll see where we go. I have been reading with both delight and trepidation the Black Panther Jungle Action Marvel Masterworks that came out 2 weeks ago that collects all of Don McGregor's run on Black Panther Jungle Action, issues 6 through 24.
Now, I thought you loved that.
I do. Yes.
Where's the trepidation come in?
The trepidation comes from the fact of I read these things when they first came out, although I was a little behind. Bless you. My goodness. I won't be able to edit that out, unfortunately.
No, you'll just have to say. Just start again. It'll be fine.
So those books were, I think, were along with Steve Gerber's work for Marvel, like my favorite best love stuff. I mean, the Jungle Action books totally... I read them repeatedly. They really changed my life about what comics could do, kind of. Like, they just, hands down, my, like, favorite storyline. And read the 12-part Panther's Rage, like, over and over and over. And growing, as I grew up, you know, the collection stayed at home, and I picked up pieces here and there, individual issues that I had reread. But nothing quite like that from the time they first came out to like the time I left for college. I really must have read them about once a year. And so rereading them in the Masterworks edition, they did a great job remastering them. The colors are very much like I remember. Everything looks great. And it's everything that you could want as a fan of those books, in that there's an introduction by Don McGregor, which... honestly, I think is better read, would have been worked better as an afterword, but they have script pages and original art, and they actually reprint his plots and some of his notes on the back. some vintage photos from the period. Like, it's really a perfect work for someone who's a fan of this stuff. The trepidation was very much my feeling of, because I'm a Don McGregor fan, and I was like, it took 10 to 15 years of people saying, wow, that guy's really a Purple Rider, you know, for me to go, wait, he is? Really? Are you, you sure? So I really picked up the books kind of going, like, I was so happy to have it, but to sit down and reread it all at once, I was really afraid of, oh God, what if this doesn't hold up? What if it's really badly overwritten and pretentious? And it is definitely, I only made it through to the end of the Panther's Rage sequence. So I still have the last, I want to say, six issues of the run left to read. It does get purple. The prose is fascinating. I'd be really curious to see what you would think of it, because on the one hand...
I like Chris Claremont, so...
Well, no, I mean, exactly. I mean, part of the reason why is I feel like the thing why I think it might work these days is we've kind of gotten through our period of, like, there's a lot of people who like stuff that is a little more batshit. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be technically great as long as it's obviously heartfelt. I mean, that I think that's what attracts a lot of us. So, like, for example, someone like Bob Haney, or like you mentioned, Claremont, or, you know, some of Gerber's excesses, you know, there's enough writers that are out there. Or even if you start going back and looking at some of the Golden Age guys, or Kirby, for example, a lot of more people talk about Kirby with a lot of love and affection for his writing and his storytelling, when, you know, previously during the period, you know, his like late Marvel period, and even during his Fourth World period, there were a lot of people who were like, well, the art's fine, but the writing, ugh. You know, I would like to think that we're at a point now where, like, if you read the Jungle Action stuff, you'd be like, yeah, okay, it's a little overwritten, but the guy's passion and everything that he's trying to do would really carry the day for you. You know what I mean? Like, you'd be like, technically not so great, but it's not awful, it's not hack work, it's not, you know, it has a lot of power to it, despite the fact that, honestly, there's some writing in there where I'm like, yeah, it's one thing that I think actually is a shame that kind of works for the larger context of the book is McGregor's introduction really talks about, like, what a shit time he was having in his life, both at Marvel Comics while trying to do this, and kind of professionally. Like, his marriage apparently fell apart at some point in this whole process, and it becomes real obvious. I mean, it looks like it becomes real obvious, because the book is not just a labor of love, but is the labor of love of somebody who's not getting enough sleep at night, you know, where it's like, it's a little too histrionic and strung out. Having said all that, A, I love the story, and you'd have to pry it from a cold dead fingers. B, I would talk about it for hours and hours and hours, so I'm really hoping that the book catches on with a lot more people. And C, interestingly enough, the book started off being drawn by Rich Buckler, who, I don't know how well you know Buckler's career, but he'd been pulled into Marvel and pretty much made to draw as much like Jack Kirby as possible. So. Yeah. He has a gorgeous, really fluid line. He does the art for the first three issues of Black Panther, and it really does. It looks like a very smooth, professional Marvel comic from that time, with those very strong Steranko influences that everyone was sort of imbibing at the time. So there's some great, like, double page title sequences where, like, there's an action sequence happening in the letters, very much from Steranko Shield and stuff like that. And it's really good work. When I was a kid, because I was so young reading it, I remember being very disappointed when Billy Graham, not to be confused with the Reverend, the other Billy Graham, took over and started doing the art chores, because his work is more cartoony and a little more grotesque. But this is the thing that was great about coming back and rereading this stuff, is even as Don McGregor's stuff isn't as great as I out and outright honestly worshipped it back when I was, like, I don't know, 10 years old or whatever, Billy Graham's storytelling is fucking amazing. amazing. Oh my God, his storytelling chops. Like, there's every once in a while there's a page that doesn't quite work, but as he goes through the Panther's Rage, that first 12-part sequence, and he's doing 9 issues of it, not only do the characters become more exaggerated and grotesque, but my God, the storytelling, like, he will lay out like these 9-panel pages in ways that I've never actually seen a 9-panel page laid out. Just some really strong, abundantly inventive storytelling, and it's one of those things that makes me think, like, it's a really strong, compelling case to be made for the Marvel method in a lot of ways. Because I mean, I haven't checked out the material closely in the background, but I assume that, you know, McGregor gave him a really tight plot, you know, he laid it out, and then McGregor went in and did the scripting afterwards. And so the scripting, there's some stuff that's a little too heavy, but there's juxtapositions between the blocks of text that McGregor uses and then the literal storytelling that Graham uses that's really unbelievably organic. Like, I'm really shocked. It is such an entirely different feel from not just the Marvel comics of the day, but comics that the way that they're done now, it's very hard to imagine them looking like this ever again, kind of. So I'm really in love with the book, and it's something that I'm, you know, I'm trying to get Hibbs has agreed to order another copy for the shelves at Comics Experience, and I definitely beseech anyone who's interested in stuff from that period. It's a lot of money up front, but it is an amazingly rewarding book to reread and revisit, I think.
Well, I think you've just sold it to me. Damn it.
You are too kind, Graham.
I had heard you talking about it before and I was not interested. But that about Billy Graham is just, damn you!
Well, that certainly is the way this particular podcast crumbles. Because the number of times where I've walked out of here, like X-Men Forever, of course.
Great. So you recommend like really good classic comics and I recommend X-Men Forever.
No. I mean, like, really good classic comics is also kind of like, you know, it's like Bob Haney's Brave and the Bold stuff. Like, it's really ambitious, but it's also like, shitty. You know, it's almost amazing how much, yeah, it's amazing how much the ambition, the grasp really exceeds the reach, you know? So yeah, but in terms of it being amazing, and unfortunately I'm so brain dead after my whole long tirade, next podcast we'll definitely talk about some of the other things that I've gone back and read on your recommendations, because that's what podcasters do.
I'm now going to continue with what I've been reading. Well, okay. Actually, I can do another prose. Mm-hmm. I can do a graphic novel I've sent from Fans Graphics, or I can do a reread of a Vertigo series that I think I've recommended to you before. Which would you want?
I think, because I pretty much expended my brain, and we're close to 7 o'clock, you should try and do all 3 of them.
Okay, I'll do them very quickly. Day Tripper, Fabio Moon Gabriel Ba miniseries. Mm-hmm. Its second last issue came out last week.
Right.
And broke format enough to make me want to go and reread everything again. Reading it all in one sitting. Mm-hmm. It makes it a much richer experience. And I say that as someone who'd been enjoying them very much in singles.
Yes.
There is such subtlety to it that when you read them all in one, you realize how incredibly well-written and well-structured it is.
Wow.
Are you following it at all?
No, I had picked up, of course, the really cheapy issue and had enjoyed it and was going to pick up more. And it was one of those things where you'd said enough good things about the singles that I'm like, okay, I'm going to go back and pick this up, but have not yet.
Get it as a trade. It reads much better in one. And I, you know, sorry DC for probably killing your single issues with that comment, but yeah, it's astonishing how well it reads in one sitting. And the gimmick is essentially that each issue tells a portion of the same character's life, and at the end of each issue he dies. And so I had initially thought, well, what it is it's, you know, alternate versions of the same man's life. Mm-hmm. But the most recent issue implies that that's not the case. And also implies that, and also when you reread, you realize how many things are set up in issues that pay off in later issues, even though the later issues happen before, the chronologically before the issues that you've already read.
Wow.
And it's just, it's wonderful. And I, also, if you do have in single issues, I think if you reread it in the chronological order, it will all pay off in a different way as well.
Wow.
For example, there is a, the first issue, the character is murdered en route to attending a speech given by his father. In, I think, the eighth issue, he leaves the speech by his father. And so it continues off from that. In the second issue, he meets a woman and falls in love with her and dies. In the third issue begins with the breakup of that relationship.
Very interesting.
And I, there's all of this going on that I've not quite figured out. There are characters who appear who you then find out in flashback were at the same events that he was at. It's wonderfully structured. I was really surprised to see how tight the writing was going back and reading all in once. I mean, the art's beautiful. It's Fabio Moon for the most part. He's just got really lush artwork. And Dave Stewart's colouring it, and his colours are spot on. They're really gentle. They're really beautiful. So that's the Vertigo series. The graphic novel was Set to Sea, and I can't remember who created that, but it's a Fantagraphics book. And I think it's out this week, and it is beautiful. It is, I mean, literally, it looks beautiful. But it's just such a lovely, precious, small story. And I really, really find myself adoring it. It's a very small, physically book, and each page is a panel. And it's, so it's actually a very short story as well. It's essentially a poem done in comics. So it's I really can't say enough good things about it, even though I cannot remember the man's name. It's Drew. I'm looking up. It's Drew Wine, W-E-I-N-G, is the name of the creator.
Interesting.
And it's just lovely. And his website is drewwine.com, drewwein.com. And you should go there because, again, he's got previews of the art. And it's just lovely, lovely, lovely. And the book has been in the back of my mind since you mentioned Scott Pilgrim and Scott being an unreliable narrator. It's a book called The Shaking Woman by Siri Hustvedt, who is actually Paul Auster's wife.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it's a memoir about the fact that after her father died, she gave a speech about her father and suddenly had convulsions during the speech that she could not control. And she had never had this happen to her before. And she thought it was a one-off occasion until it started coming to her again. And it's a memoir about where does it come from that spins off into theories about the brain. Theories about memory, theories about personality, theories about language. It's maybe, I mean, it's short, it's 200 pages perhaps, but it's just this mind-bending book about the way that the mind works. And the reason I would remember it when you're talking to Scott Pilgrim is one of the things that she says is apparently scientists have discovered that when you remember something, you're not remembering the event as it occurred, you're remembering the way that you remembered it last time. And that each memory of event overwrites your previous memory of that. So that if you misremember something, you, from that point on, only remember the misremembering.
Right. It becomes that sort of photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy.
Yeah. That's all you do. You have no original memory anymore.
Wow.
Memories are constantly overwritten.
That's both impressive and terrifying and somehow comic related, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm the book is full of things like that. I don't know if you listen to Radiolab. I think we've gotten into this before, the NPR show. Right. Radiolab's most recent episode is about language and about the essentially the value of language and what language brings to us, not only in terms of communication but also in terms of ourself, in terms of, you know, what it means. And one of the thoughts within it is that without language, we would not understand certain abstract concepts. We need the language to understand the concept.
Right.
And that people who have no language essentially are unable to think as the way that we think.
Yes.
And so going from that, which I heard on a Saturday morning, to reading this book on a Saturday afternoon, you know, which is all about, you know, how the brain works and how we are constantly rewriting ourselves, mm-hmm. because our memories are constantly overwriting what we know about ourselves. It's just one of those incredible, you know, brain-crushing moments.
I was about to say, like, that must have been a hell of a Saturday for your self-identity.
Well, no, exactly. You sort of come away thinking, I don't know what I feel about all of that.
Well, well done, sir. Those actually all sound incredibly interesting and worth checking out.
Well, thank you very much. I would heartily recommend Day Tripper. I think you'll really, really like Day Tripper.
Yeah. I'm very. I definitely think that getting the trade is now a gimme. I think that I'll just jump to that route and see how that works out, because that sounds great.
Because you are finally getting into the library system, look for the Shaking Woman. Look for the Siri Hirsfeld book. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I definitely will, because it's a great description and it has a whole bunch of interesting things that. Resonate with me personally and professionally, so that sounds fabulous.
And we did that in about half an hour. We actually managed to mm-hmm. pack all that into. This must be the most action-packed Wade Watt ever. we cut to the chase for once.
We actually did, and I hope our listeners will forgive us. I would like to think that between part one's yin and this yang, no one will have anything to complain about.
You should just edit them all together. So they've got like a long, long intro and then half an hour of us talking about comics.
To be fair, I'm sure that's kind of how it will come off to them anyway. So, well, on that note, we should wrap it up. This was wonderful. I'm going to try and sort of edit and turn this around. And who knows, maybe we can do this again next week or something.
Yeah, I know. If we can make this a weekly thing, god damn it.
I know. I think that would be pretty brilliant.